Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Ohio Historical Center has a birthday coming up in August. It's 40th birthday, but you can almost still hear the griping about the architectural style of the building, which is situated along the west side of 71 near the Ohio Expo Center. We'll talk about that and the celebration with Barbara Powers. She manages the inventory and registration for the Ohio Historic Preservation Office. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Hi, Ann. Glad to be here.
And David Simmons, he edits the Ohio Historical Society's Timeline magazine. David, I'm glad you could be with us.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
And also the Society's Communications and Media Relations Manager makes a return appearance on the show. Kim Schutte, welcome to the show.
Always glad to be here.
History's so much fun, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. It's always something new about the past.
Exactly. It is a growing business in a way, isn't it? There's always something new. The Dispatch ran an article earlier this month about the architectural style of the Ohio Historical Center, and there were still people out there complaining. And I wondered, do you think as a citizenry, as a populace, we'll ever get used to it, or do we even want to, Barbara?
Well, I guess it wouldn't be called good architecture if it didn't elicit strong emotions. And that's entirely what the building was intended to do when it was first designed and apparently continues to do today, as we all know. The building was meant to be an inspiring piece of architecture, a bold, dramatic statement. It was meant to not complement, but to
contrast
from the collections that were to be held within the building and the records that were stored in the building.
You know, we think of with Historical Society sort of ivy-covered, red brickish type colonial kind of buildings. Why something bold like this? Why that for a Historical Society?
Well, the Historical Society actually started out on the OSU fairgrounds. Their first building was their first building for of their
Quonset
own.
Was it a Quonset hut?
No. Their first building of their own, their first exhibits were actually in the State House.
Okay.
But their first building of their own was built pretty much like a traditional museum with the columns and the marble and all that. And that's Sullivan Hall now on the OSU campus. And the connection between the Historical Society and OSU was very close. And even the president of OSU, Bill Thompson, was on the OHS trustees. So they actually gave the land. 1914, they built it. Following World War I, they had crowding issues. They built an addition. But then by the 60s, that facility was a library and museum and was overflowing. Plus, the society had been designated as the official state archives, and the old governor's mansion on Broad Street was identified as the archives facility at 1234 Broad Street. And that's where the Columbus Foundation is now.
Okay.
And that building was overflowing, and they had to acquire another warehouse to hold all the archives. So by 1960, things were just really filled up and looking for new space.
Kind of like the hoarders, you know, that kind of a picture.
Well, you know, historical societies are essentially hoarders.
We've demonized that on television, but does the Historical Society still have all the stuff that it had back then? Does it just
and more.
Keep it? And
we
more.
Have about more. 3 million pieces in our collections.
Where do they stay now? At the center?
Some of it. We have much at our sites. We have 58 sites.
Right.
And then we have warehouses that are provided to us by the state of Ohio.
We are talking about the Ohio Historical Center. Its birthday's coming up in August. There are special events planned for that. We'll get to that later. Joining me in the studio, Barbara Powers. She is manages the inventory and registration for the Ohio Historic Preservation Office. And also David Simmons. He edits the Ohio Historical Society's Timeline magazine. And Kim Schutte, the Society's Communications and Media Relations Manager, is with us as well. So if you have a question or comment for them, they'll be with us for the next half hour or so. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. allsides.org, or you can go to Allsides Facebook page. It's Allsides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and make your question or comment there. So when they designed the building, what kind of direction did they give the architect? Did they say big and bold and amazing, or did he come up with that himself?
Well, the architectural program for the building, the architect who was Byron Ireland, he'd been trained at the Harvard School of Design, and he had worked with Eero Saarinen, a leading architect, modern architect, who's probably best known for the St. Louis Arch and also the TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport in New York City. So if you think about, if you're familiar with that building and the big swooping roof line, right. And Byron Ireland was the project designer for that building. So Ireland's charge was to combine the historical museum that had been on OSU's campus, the Historical Society's library, and the archives library all into one facility. It was a facility that was meant to be able to accommodate large numbers of visitors, and also the site, the 58-acre site on the state fairgrounds, offered an opportunity to take advantage of the natural curve that had been created as the, at that time, in the late 60s, the newly built Interstate 71 okay. was basically ran in front of the building site. So Ireland chose to create a memorable image, and in doing that, also created quite a daring architectural feat. And what he did, his design to accomplish all those requirements, was to create actually what the director at the time, Daniel Porter, called something of a sandwich, an architectural sandwich. You have the museum floor laid out on the first floor, which is actually below the mound and the built-up area of the site. Then that's the bottom part of the sandwich, if you will. Then the middle portion is the glass-walled plaza level, which you go up through the ramps and the twin staircases that wind around the mound in front of the building that was created in front of the building. Mm-hmm. And then the top is the block of the archives library block, which literally appears to float out over the plaza level and is the cantilever design that projects actually 40 feet out from its center core.
Now, there is a funny story. After the structure was completed and they were getting ready to take away the braces, the workers weren't exactly sure of their own work.
Well, this was quite an architectural feat, as I mentioned, and this perhaps could be one of the longest cantilevers, the unsupported beams that was tried at this time. So the shoring up, the supports were at the corners of the building. And as the story goes, Peter Korda, who was working with Byron Ireland as the structural engineer, was so confident of the work and the post-tensioning, the compression, the structure of the building, that when they were to release the structure, the shoring at the corners, he confidently stood under the cantilever with his hard hat on, and as the story goes, the structure deflected about a fourth of an inch, and all was well. But apparently there was quite a bit of speculation that the building would fall down, that it wouldn't be able to support itself.
So they specifically designed it this way visually because it would stand out as you're driving by on 71. It was intended that way versus just another building dropped in from New Albany, just another red brick building.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It was meant to get attention. And, you know, the interstate was just being designed and or
at the same time?
Yeah. Pretty close to it.
Modern architecture focuses on you've heard the phrase form follows function. It focuses on the functions of the building being articulated through the material, the spaces, and doing that in a way that is creating an artful expression, an architectural expression that takes advantage of the materials. And in this case, the massive block of the archives library is actually faced in a clay glazed silo tile. So One could say it harkens back to our agricultural history. It's a Ohio manufactured product, so it capitalizes on that aspect of Ohio's industrial heritage. And then the concrete. We can't ignore the concrete. The concrete is purposely board formed, and when you look closely at the walls and much of the structure of the building, you'll see that the indentions in the surface are actually appear to be boards, and you can see knot holes and other aspects of that. That was an intentional method to first of all celebrate and draw attention to the nature of concrete and the structural substance of the building's construction, but also the board form adds texture to the building, to those wall surfaces. It adds a human scale, and it also adds an level of interest. That's complemented throughout the building with natural oak wood trim doors and other features. So very simple materials, no marble or other fancy materials, very simple economical materials, but all expressed in a very purposeful, artful way.
So right off the bat, David, were people complaining?
Well, the reactions to the building were actually pretty positive from the architectural community, but there have always been critics as they still exist. But those that understand structure understand the daring qualities. And Dan Porter, when he was, as Barb mentioned, the first director when the building was built, he would make a point that there was, in fact, no exotic materials in this building, that they were all had some kind of Buckeye connection, especially in terms of the concrete itself. So even the idea of using post-stressed tension concrete, was something that those of us that have been working on this exhibit really marvel that the people that were involved in creating the building, outside of the architect himself, who had a wide range of experience with this, that they had to understand and appreciate. This was a group of trustees, board of trustees. And the head of the committee for the building was Don Weaver, who was at the time retired but had been the editor of the Columbus Journal. So he had experience with lots of controversial issues, but he was basically an older white guy that had this vision of doing something really creative and novel. In fact, the trustees said, we want to have a modern, inspiring piece of architecture. So right from the beginning, the people that were involved had a vision of creating something very special.
We have to take a quick break. We come back, we'll get some calls in, and we'll talk more about the Ohio Historical Center. It's celebrating its birthday, its 40th birthday. Can join the fun. We'll talk about that later as well when we return. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I love the comments we get on our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, so go there and comment as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock, and it's Wednesday, so the political junkie is stopping by to discuss all things politics. And the air may be thinner in Colorado, but political junkie Ken Rudin is hooked on the state's hot political contests. Guest host Tony Cox has a Rocky Mountain edition of Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock this afternoon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. A few clouds and a little bit of sunshine today. Also a slight chance of afternoon rain, a high near 90. A good chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, and a low of 71. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Ohio Historical Center and its 40th birthday coming up. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you would like to join the conversation with Barbara Powers, David Simmons, and Kim Schutte of the Ohio Historical Society. And Henry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's been a while since I've been on. Anyway, contrary to what the people from the Historical Society say, I'd like to say the design of the building is stupid.
Okay.
And I will explain why.
Okay.
First, if you want to put a volume inside something, the largest volume you can put for surface area is a sphere. The next thing you can, largest thing you can put inside is a box, such as a rectangle would not be quite as good as a square. The roof of the Historical Society has always leaked. It's flat. Rainwater has always come down from the inside. They had to fix the roof several times because it leaked. Second of all, I mentioned that the largest volume you can put inside a building would be a square. There was a lot of wasted space under the overhang. There was an overhang above the exhibit area. And so that space is wasted.
Well, I mean, though it's wasted, but if they had built it out, that would
they built it
be
out,
built out, and it would be
out, but
more
it's
money.
Wasted.
Okay. Well,
and they should have made use of it. I think it's a nice idea that they used Ohio materials to build a thing, but when it comes down to having exhibits, I do not think the building is really well set up.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned two kind of technical issues, the
yes.
roof leaking and also the waste of space that you perceive from the cantilever. Do you just not like how it looks as well, or do you kind of like how it looks if you didn't have to worry about those other two issues?
If I didn't care whether it was functional or mm-hmm. not, or would have exhibits, I would say it's very interesting.
Okay.
Now, wait, wait.
What?
Now, if architects really want to come up with a brilliant design, why don't they come up with an Egyptian-type pyramid and build it point downward?
Well, that would be copying, sort of. But
no,
but listen, well, Henry, let's hear
it'd
from.
It'd be brilliant. No one could do it.
Let's hear from. Weird to get into, but let's hear from our guests now. You've heard these criticisms before, David, no doubt.
Henry is right in the sense that the roof had issues in terms of the part, the exhibit floor in particular. And with a lot of new technology, you know, architecture that's sort of pushing the envelope, you're going to have technical issues. And one of the issues was that they were sort of ahead of the game in terms of how you seal a roof like that, basically an underground building. And that's right, they did have to come in and strip that out and put in a new roof. But that's essentially working now as it was originally functioned. So apart from the fact that the original design didn't work, you know, it can work and has worked now.
Okay.
And also, you know, to add to the comment about the wasted space of the plaza level, that's meant for, you know, gatherings. We'd like to have people in our museum. We like to have functions. And, you know, we do have exhibits there, but it's also meant to be a space for interaction with people.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think people might not necessarily pay attention to, but I want to point out, is on the exhibit floor, the roof of the exhibit floor is supported by massive cruciform concrete columns.
Is that like crisscross?
And they're crisscrosses. Okay. They're like big X's. And in part, that was an intentional space-saving device and also a multi-purpose device. Not only are those cross-form columns supporting the roof of the exhibit area, which spreads out for, I think, something like
Three and a half acres.
But if you just had big, fat columns there, you really would obstruct views and these cross forms allow exhibits to be displayed and to be used as surfaces that can also help add to and be a part of the exhibit design and display of materials in addition to providing the support.
And the fact that they're very plain and unadorned means that they're not going to interfere with appreciation of the artifacts and materials that are displayed there. And that was, I think, part of the original purpose.
There have been problems with the building. I mean, I guess the leak, the windows were a problem for a while, or the skylights, I should say. That posed a problem.
In the library, again, they perhaps had not thought of issues like UV control, and, and the most recent remodeling, refitting of those windows put in UV protection. So,
also, it was built, the Americans with Disabilities Act is celebrating its own anniversary right now, 20 years since it was enacted, and the building didn't exactly work well when the ADA was passed. You had to change the entrances.
The entrance was put down on the lower level to accommodate that. And the original design with the mound in the front with the two, lovely aesthetic sidewalks going up to the top of the mound have always been an area of criticism because they were designed to look good, but they're hard to use when you walk up and down them. So that was always an issue of criticism when it opened.
Even before the ADA.
Even before the ADA. But the society has investigated putting in a new elevator to get people up to the plaza level again from the outside. But that has been cost prohibitive, at least in the current environment.
Kim?
Well, I mean, I think learning during this whole process of architecture, we found out that the way it was designed going up the steps were meant to impress. You know, it's monumental, and Barb likens it to the Ohio State House.
It has been. Other scholars have – it's second only to the State House in its, uniqueness.
Right. Well, when it first opened, it was covered widely, nationwide, in architectural journals and press in the press. And the Architectural Record article said that it was the most significant public building to be built in Ohio since the Ohio State House. And, again, you might just sort of brush that off as a passing comment. But when you think about the building and you think about the State House and you think about the monumental entrance, as Kim was describing, the stairs and the ramps that are going up to the plaza level, and then once inside the building, you think of traditional architecture really creating a hierarchy of spaces. The most important spaces are the most dramatic spaces within a building. And just like the rotunda and legislative chambers in the State House, you have the plaza level, you have the reading room, which was described as a monumental baronial space with the coffered high three-story open space, which is literally suspended over nothing. It's suspended over the plaza level and then down into the stairwell that goes into the exhibit area. So it's quite a dramatic space. And also the cantilever portions of the building that kind of hang out over nothing. So
yeah, it has its ways about it. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
I was in the building fairly early after it was built, and I noticed that there had been cantilevers, there were repair plates, and I was interested in the history of those.
Actually, those are not repair plates. Those are the places, because it's a post-stressed structure as opposed to a pre-stressed structure, they had to leave places to attach jacks, hydraulic jacks, and that's what those patches are. Those places you see are where the jacks were actually attached to the end of the cables, and then the tension was applied to the cables with those jacks and a grout or something to hold the cable in place was put in those against those columns, and then the jacks were taken away, and those patches were put over to close up those places. There are actually two of those places in the building that were left open for people to see that sort of the ends of the cables and how that processed work there in the plaza area. But those things that look like patches were actually part of the original design.
Okay, well, thank you very much for answering that question.
Okay, Doug.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Now, to make any big changes to the building right now is not in the cards because funding for the Ohio Historical Society has changed a lot in the last few years, last 7 years, 40% cut in funding from the state at least.
That's our operating budget.
Right, your operating budget.
Capital budget, we don't know yet, but, the thing is that we are planning some changes, at least internally.
Okay.
We plan to change the exhibits around. We are going to focus more on collections learning. So structurally, we still have to wait to see how that pans out for the capital budget. But internally, we are progressing with our plan to sort of change the exhibits around, which some of them haven't been changed for about 20 years. So.
Now, this starting in August, for the month of August, mm-hmm. I should say, you're going to have Saturdays free. Can you tell us what you're doing to celebrate and what some of the exhibits are that people might want to catch before the end of August?
Well, we are having Saturdays free. Of course, we're open on Thursdays and Fridays as well. We want to honor the building's 40th anniversary. We are having tours. The tours, where some of us are leading those too, will be on Saturday at 12 and 2, and it's called It's Brutal. So we're explaining the brutalism style of architecture. We are showing the high points. We'll be pointing out the stress cables David just talked about. We'll be showing people the concrete, the treatment that was given to the concrete, the floating stairs. So we'll be taking people tours of the building to try to explain to them about the building and why it is a feat of architecture. So those are happening on Saturdays in August. We will also be they can also come and see our exhibits that we have there. We have a display on Devo, and the band is coming to the Ohio State Fair. Yeah, the Akron born.
Do they know about the exhibit? Of course.
Yes, they do, and they donated some items from their memorabilia. We have a energy dome. We have the Devo costume. We have Devo album covers, stickers, T-shirts.
But you also made the connection to Devolution,
right?
Which is where talk about
right.
that a little bit.
Well, they wanted to. They got their name from a. Anti-Darwinian pamphlet called Jocko Homo Heaven Bound. Is that right, David?
Something like that. Yeah,
yeah. Something like
from
that.
From the 20s.
Right. And we have that in our collection. So that's there on display. So people could come see Devo. And the name of the exhibit is named after one of their albums, Are We Not Man? Answer, We Are Devo. So that's on our third floor. We're having a little fun. And we can show that, history is happening, even recent history. It's important to collect and to keep those connections that are Ohio-based history. And Devo certainly made a huge impact on our pop culture in the 80s. So.
How do you measure something like that, that it's made, that it's iconic enough, that it's made that kind of an impact enough to warrant inclusion in your collection?
Well, I think that's up to we have curators mm-hmm. that determine that for us. But for me, it's like, gee, I can still remember the song. So.
And so can I, and that just dates us.
Yes,
Kim.
Yes, it sure does.
I remember them on MTV.
And then people can come to see our permanent exhibits. We have The Nature of Ohio. We have Ohio Centuries of Change, where people can go from our prehistoric past all the way up until the 70s. We have two exhibits that are still there through the end of August called Were You There? An Illustrated Spiritual by Alan Rohan Crite, which are beautifully detailed illustrations of Jesus crucifixion with African Americans in the primary roles. We also have Quilts with Soul, which has seven extraordinary art quilts from African American artists on display. And then also we are doing some experiments with our new collections learning concept that we have.
And what's that?
Well, that's where we, you know, people have told us that they want to know the real stuff of history. They want to see more of our collections. They want us to bring it out and to either research it or to just learn about it and see it. So we have tried, we are trying right now and testing five different examples of the way people could learn. Comparative collections where in our archives library, people could go and see a collection of Civil War belt buckles and then compare, you know, learn about how if they have something like that from their great-great-grandfather, they can learn more about it and find out the history and where it was made. And so we'll be changing that type of, you know, with other different types of comparative collections. Let's say if you collected, well, quilts would be pretty mm-hmm. large, but quilts or porcelain, china, I mean, there's just the list is endless okay. of what you could research. So we're starting now with Civil War belt buckles. We have a wonderful exhibit on the first floor that sort of gets you involved in the story. You know, people want to learn more about history, and they want to know about the stories of history. And this one is bringing out the Knight's Panorama, which tells the story of Andrew's raid in the Civil War. David can probably tell more about the raid itself, but it's just a wonderful thing to see this panorama and what was used to tell the story of Knight's raid.
It's an early audiovisual aid before we had PowerPoint and even slide projectors and that sort of thing. William Knight, who was on Andrew's raid during the Civil War, when he came back to Ohio, he was from Williams County, started doing talks, lectures on the raid itself. And he had an artist from Akron named Ruger prepare, I think it's 15 panels. And these are like 7 by 7 foot panels put on a roll, and he would show one panel, and then after he was done talking to that, he would roll up to the next panel. And that was his audiovisual aid for explaining the whole raid.
Do you remember the Buster Keaton movie, The General? That's what it was based off of.
Okay.
And Mickey Mouse had a movie, too,
right.
The Great Locomotive Chase. So it was a pretty famous story in Civil War history that had a big Ohio connection because a lot of the raiders were from Ohio. So we have that. We also have a history, what is it? You know, we're bringing out our collections and making people guess what they are. And, you know, most of the items will tell you the answer when you read through it, but others we still don't know. And we're taking, you know, if people know what they are, we're open to suggestions.
Tell me quick, we just have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about Ohio's Garden Path, the flowering of our landscape. What does that involve?
Well, that is where we're talking about how we developed our gardens and our habits here in Ohio, our passion for gardening and landscaping. And so it gives us a history of just wonderful gardens in Ohio, how people gardened. Edina, we illustrate Edina Mansion and Gardens because mm-hmm. that's like one of the first beautiful examples, and then how it developed in our suburbs and cities and in the countryside. So it's really a nice little history of how Ohio started their passion for gardening.
Okay, we're out of time on this topic. I really appreciate Barbara Powers having you join us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, and also David Simmons. Thanks for being with us and explaining
the
building.
Glad to be here.
And Kim Schutte, thanks for joining us again on the show.
Oh, always. And we hope people come to the Ohio Historical Center for the tours on Saturdays.
Saturdays, free Saturdays in August to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Ohio Historical Center. You can probably learn more on the Ohio Historical Society website, and we'll post that on our website at wosu.org/allsides so you can get all the information you need. So celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Ohio Historical Center in August with us. That's all the time we have for this right now. When we return, we'll have Jonathan Riskin from the Columbus Dispatch to talk about another topic out of Washington. Join us then. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We can be so closed in. And when you listen to WOSU, they address things from more than one point of view. It's a global point of view, and you realize that you are indeed a citizen of the world and not just a citizen of Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joyce Eubanks, and WOSU is my source for a worldview.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about the science of how and why we dream. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Today at noon, it's Painting the World Scarlet and Gray, featuring the Vice Provost for Global Strategies and International Affairs at The Ohio State University. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org. Currently 76 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41. A few clouds and a little sunshine today. There is a slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 90. A good chance of rain showers, maybe a thunderstorm later this afternoon and into tonight. Mostly cloudy and a low of 71 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're switching gears here now to talk about the state and its race to the top competition. Ohio is a finalist in the federal Race to the Top competition. It's through the U.S. Department of Education. They announced that yesterday. And joining us today from Washington, Jonathan Riskind, Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann. It's great to be on the show.
I appreciate it. I know you're feeling a little under the weather today, and I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us.
It's no problem. I enjoy the show.
What is the Race to the Top competition?
Race to the Top competition is the Obama administration's attempt to entice schools with federal dollars to do the types of education reform plans that Secretary of Education Duncan and President Obama believe will improve the schools. It's, in a sense, a continuation of President Bush's No Child Left Behind law that Congress passed, although that's a whole other story because the No Child Left Behind law is up for renewal, and President Obama would like to have it renewed and revised, tweaked a little bit differently along the and that apparently is not going to happen this year. Like many things are not going to happen this year. That won't happen. But the Race to the Top was money included in the economic stimulus bill, $4.35 billion.
Right.
And it basically is a competition for states to say, here's what we would do to close student achievement gaps between minority students and white students, for instance, raise teacher performance, and then the Obama administration, I think, would like to tie those two things together. Student performance tied to teacher pay, for instance, is one idea, and something that a lot of teachers are not very keen on. And then overall, how states and communities would improve low performing schools. None of these are new concepts. Mm-hmm. Federal government has been trying to get states and local schools to do national standards, you know, ever since they did pass No Child Left Behind law, and even before. This is saying, we'll give you a pot of money and to help you do this. And so there's $4.35 billion out there. Ohio was a finalist in the first round of funding and was a losing finalist. And as a matter of fact, only two states got money in the first round of funding, Tennessee and Delaware. $100 million for Delaware, $400 million for Tennessee. And that was a sort of a sticking point for a lot of states. There were 16 finalists. Only two states got money. And a lot of the states said, hey, what's going on here?
Why even make them finalists?
Right, exactly. And you only get awarded two states. And Ohio applied again for the second round of funding. And this will be very interesting because 19 states are finalists this time. And Secretary of Education Duncan has said that he believes 10 to 15 states will get money this time, and we can get into more detail on all this in terms of why the first time they only selected two states, why more states this time. But Ohio again is a finalist.
Are most of the 19 states, were they finalists the first time around? Do we know that?
Yeah, a good number of them were. There's a few new finalists. California, I believe, was not. I don't think even applied the first time around. But for instance, since New York is a finalist again, and they applied the first time around. Maryland did not apply the first time around. So there's a few new additions, but on the other side, a number of states, I think nine, did not apply at all this time for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Some, there's disagreement in some states that they should get the federal government, as you know from your days as a state house reporter with our paper and The Blade, mm-hmm. Long disagreements among a lot of state lawmakers about how much influence the federal government should have on state and local education policy. So some states balk, saying we're not going to participate. We don't want to have, be made to do something just for some more federal money. And other states figured out that they don't think they can win the money because they couldn't change their state laws and regulations to do some of the things they knew would be needed to win the money.
Federal officials said that one of the big reasons Delaware and Tennessee came out winners was because all the local districts in those states signed on to the reform plan. And Ohio, the first time around, had 51% participation rate among its 613 school districts and 322 charter schools. And this time around, they've raised that rate to 57%.
Yeah, and that's after a huge lobbying push right. by Governor Strickland. And it doesn't sound like it's a very big improvement. It is better. Now, on the other hand, though, in talking to one education expert yesterday, a guy named Jack Jennings with the Center on Education Policy in Washington, mm-hmm. He said that, that's just one factor, and he doesn't believe that it means, that a state like Ohio is not going to win this time around. It may be the factor that they chose to award on the last time around, but this time, especially if they're going to give to more states, and we can talk about that issue mm-hmm. in a minute, but if they're going to give the money to more states, there's California, for instance, didn't even try to get all its districts to participate. They put together a plan involving, as I understand it, 10 districts that would do some innovative things as a cluster. And so that's what they're looking for money to help.
Now,
they don't necessarily need – Jennings is saying, this expert is saying, they don't necessarily need to have full participation. And Secretary of Education Duncan told reporters on a conference call yesterday that is the case also. He actually said specifically that he thinks Ohio has a competitive application.
Now, Ohio, last time the application was 262 pages. The current one is 378 pages. And the only reason why I bring that up is they must have paid somebody, they're spending money to apply in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think the money they're spending is for the most part, state education department resources, time, and expertise.
Okay.
I don't think they're spending a whole bundle of money to apply. And I think what they did was they sort of tweaked this application. They talked to, I think, educators and around the state. They sort of looked at the federal comments from the last time around. They did hold some events around the state with educators and stakeholders and for teachers, et cetera, parents. And I think they tried to tweak it to be a little more specific about some things, come up with, some ways that they would try to raise student achievement levels, close gaps between minority students and white students, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was, a radically different proposal.
Yeah, politics, of course, plays a role. And even if it doesn't, we could talk about it anyway. Many unions objected to the call for evaluating teachers based in part on student performance. And so there's a little pushback from the unions. That's a important constituent or has been traditionally an important constituent in Democratic politics. How is that playing for someone like, Governor Strickland, Democrat and friend of the unions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at it a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like Nixon going to Well, let's forget the Nixon-China example. Actually, it's the reverse. I mean, you've got Strickland, who is a big friend of the unions, and if anybody can get the unions to go along with this, it presumably would be Strickland because they know that he's not their enemy. He is, in most ways, their friend. And so maybe it's more like Clinton and welfare reform in that sense, telling welfare advocates, look, we got to get a little tougher on people. We got to make people work. They can't just stay on welfare. And that's the only way to get people off welfare is to get a little tougher. And I think Strickland is saying the same things to the teachers. I think on the teacher's side, I think there's a sense of, now look, if kids have a rough home life, if there's a variety of reason why kids are having trouble in school, a lot of societal reasons, you know, we're doing our best here, we work hard, you can't punish us for society's overall failings. So there's, I think, a little bit of median.
How important is this? You know, as you know, I know you're not Statehouse anymore, but you know, the state's facing that estimated $8 billion shortage, budget shortfall coming up, and they're going to talk about that after the November elections probably. But with this funding, could it be used creatively to offset some of the some potential cuts coming up?
I think that's possible. I mean, you know, there's some education dollars and additional stimulus type funding that states were hoping to get that it's pretty certain will not happen this year. Mm-hmm. And so that, it's not something that a state like Ohio would hope would happen. It's probably not going to happen this year. Probably not, maybe not next year either. So, I mean, $400 million is a lot of money that can be used in education that they presumably, now some of that would be new dollars, new programs, but still you'd have to think that every dollar counts at this point. And then the other thing is, in terms of the politics of it, and like you said, maybe it's not politics, but hey, we can always make it that way, can't we? The politics of it, I think, is that Governor Strickland is a Democratic governor, someone that presumably has an in with the Obama administration. Okay, he supported Hillary Clinton, but Ben was a loyal worker for Barack Obama when Obama got the nomination. Ohio is an incredibly key state. Obama knows he's in Ohio again to be reelected in 2012. He wants Governor Strickland to win this year in his race against Republican John Kasich. So Strickland needs to be able to argue that, you know, having him as a governor has some positive positive outcomes with the Obama administration. Otherwise, why is he there in that sense? And so he needs to be able to say, hey, look, you know, I won this race to the top contest, and if he loses it again, people might say, well, you know, gee, even if this politics shouldn't be involved in this, and even if this should be made purely on the merits and by the federal education officials, and politics shouldn't enter their heads, mm-hmm. people are still going to look at it that way, I think. And this is something that I think is very important to Strickland politically.
Well, conversely, the timing of this, they didn't make it through the first round, but the timing on making it in the second round could be more advantageous, right?
Yeah,
because the timing.
Ironically, that's true. I mean, they're going to announce the winners in September. States are going to send people to Washington the week of August 8th or 9th and make presentations, and then the winners will be announced in September. So, you know, right as the race is heating up, the governor's race is heating up, we'll get this announcement. So it could help, or frankly, it could hurt.
It could hurt. The $400 million that Ohio is seeking, that's the most a state can win. Is that – would Ohio necessarily get the entire $400 million that it's seeking?
That's not necessarily. Now, Tennessee and Delaware, my understanding, is what they full amount they requested. But now, here's the deal. There's $3.4 billion left to give out at this moment. There was $4.35 billion originally set aside for this. $350 billion is set aside for a slightly different kind of a thing, giving money to states that have come up with ways to assess progress on their education reform plan. So take that out. So $4 billion, 500 or so million has been given out already. But the bottom line is there's $3.4 billion left to give out right now. But as Secretary Duncan noted to reporters yesterday, of the 19 finalists, they've asked for a total of $6.2 billion. So they could do this a couple different ways. They could give everybody their full allotment to fewer winners, or they could have more winners and maybe cut down the amounts a little bit. Mm-hmm. They give Ohio $300 million. And that'll be interesting to see what they decide to do. I guess that's a good segue before we run out of time into the politics on the federal side of this, on the Obama side of this. And in Congress, there was some real anger when they only awarded grants to Delaware and Tennessee in the first round. And, lawmakers, they want to be able to tell their states and their constituents that they're having some impact in Washington. And, you know, that left 48 states where lawmakers had to say, couldn't say anything about the race to the top competition in terms of how it helped their state. So this time around, as I said, Duncan has indicated 10 to 15 states will get awards, and I really have to believe that it'll be 10 to 15 states, because otherwise there could be a revolt by lawmakers, and they could try to rescind some of this money. And furthermore, Obama wants another $1 billion or so dollars to do a third round of funding for this. He wants to keep this going, and there just ain't no way that they'll get more money if there aren't allocations made to a fair number of states this time around. And if they really only gave to a couple states again, I honestly think that they might try to take away the money. So it's going to be real interesting to see how the Obama administration treats it this time.
We just have a few minutes left, but if folks want to find out if their school district signed on, and I guess you have to submit agreements, each district signed by their superintendent, school board president, and union representative. If they want to find out if their district is one of the 435 in Ohio that have signed on, where would they go? How would they find something like that out, besides having to call up there?
I think they could probably go to the Ohio Department of Education website or Governor Strickland's governor's website and find out. Or I assume they could call their local school districts or go to the local school district's website and find out for themselves. I apologize. I don't have something automatically off the top of my head. I know my if you're probably talking to Kathy Kandisky, my State House colleague, she would know exactly how you would find out. But my guess is with a couple of clicks, you would find out pretty easily.
Kathy's on vacation, but we'll find that link if you want to find out where your school district is in this program. Go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll find that link and we'll post it so you can figure that one out. John, love to talk to you again sometime. Hope you're feeling better soon.
I appreciate it. I'd love to come on the show anytime. It's always fun to talk politics with you, Ann.
You too. Take care.
All right, thanks.
That's all the time we have with Jonathan Riskind. If you want to find out if your district is part of the proposal from the state of Ohio for the federal Race to the Top competition, you can go to our website and we'll find that link and we will post it. So thanks again for listening right now. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.